It's March 1990, and this month on the 90s Movie Pod, we finally inject some much-needed sex appeal into the pod with the fabulous Baker Boys. That Beau Bridges, eh? Whoa. We also rage at the annual injustice that is the Oscars, where to our shock and dismay, the exquisite Tango and Cash fails to secure that much-deserved nomination for Most British Accent. Then we finish up with a yuppie nightmare triple bill. First, The War of the Roses, which examines the inherent horror of materialistic marriages. Then Weekend at Bernie's, which catalogues the horror of hanging out with corpses all weekend. And then finally Rude Awakening, where we, the viewer, confront a horror more powerful than we could ever imagine. All that and much more coming up on this edition of the 90s Movie Pod. Hey everyone, welcome back. It's episode 3, 90s Movie Pod. You've come back, that's good. We are now covering March 1990, and we have a bumper slate of 90s cinema to talk about today. It's Oscars month. We're going to be talking about that Oscar ceremony, and we have some great comedies, some terrible comedies, some great action, some real sexiness, the whole smorgasbord of 90s cinema, I think. But first, we'll say hello to everyone. Hello, Joe. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Paul. How are you?
Very well. Very, very well indeed. What have you been up to since the last pod?
I've been watching a lot of films.
Yeah.
There's a lot of films to get through today, and I even went so far as to rewatch something from last month. So something maybe to pick up from the final episode.
Oh. New info.
There was some disagreements about Lockup.
There were.
At the end of the last episode. And you guys are all good friends of mine, and to greater or lesser extent, I respect your opinions. So I thought it's probably worth a rewatch. I went back, I had another look at it in a, you know, maybe the first time I watched it, I wasn't really in the mood for it.
Oh.
But I watched it again.
It's promising.
A positive setup. I really wanted to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Garbage. I'm sorry to say, I stick with my original opinion.
Rubbish. I would say you need to watch it maybe twice more. Then I'll be willing to accept you. I just feel like you missed something this time. Maybe the light, you know, it's too light in the room, it's a bit hot.
When was it? What night of the week?
You had a big dinner.
It was a weeknight.
So you're already stressed from after work. Absolutely. You're not in the right frame of mind for this piece of cinema. It needs to be Saturday night.
Or Friday night.
A few beers in.
A takeaway.
Candles.
Yeah.
Candles. You need to be in the bath.
Yeah. Tissues at the ready.
Rose petals everywhere. Okay. So, Adam, how about you? Did you rewatch Lockup?
No, but I wish I Why had, not? To be honest. I know, such a mistake. I've wasted a week, really.
Yeah, well, luckily we did get to watch one Stallone film.
Oh, my word.
This week, but we'll come on to that. Up to anything else recently?
Oh, me, not much. Just watching 7 films in a very short space of time.
Fair enough. Daz, how about you? You alright?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm looking forward to the sexiness in today's episode.
The first
film we're going to discuss, that was probably the highlight of my week.
About time things got sexy around here.
It is.
March is the sexiest month after all.
Well, I was born in March, so that
take
might
it back.
Story checks out. Yeah. Well, there are a few themes emerging in this year, I should say, and in these films we've watched so far. One of the surprising ones that's come out is the prevalence of less talented siblings appearing in films. So far, and correct me if I'm missing any, Clint Howard, Chris Penn, Eric Roberts, this month we've got Beau Bridges.
That's right.
And a number of Baldwins.
Mm-hmm.
Any others that we're...
Maybe it was a cameo from Frank Stallone somewhere.
Maybe.
Yeah, we'll have to check that out.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
So when we get on to talking about the Fabulous Baker Boys, one of the things I read... obviously stars Jeff and Beau Bridges, another brother pairing that were considered, Dennis and Randy Quaid.
Yeah.
Oh wow.
Which would have been a very different film, I think.
Yeah.
I guess Dennis Quaid would have been Jeff Bridges.
Yes. That's it would have been very different, but you know immediately which role they would
be.
Yeah.
Dennis is the sexier Quaid. I don't think there's any...
100%, yeah.
Yeah.
Although Randy's playing clearly Beau Bridges' role as a Amish bowling champion.
Although isn't there a Randy Quaid sex tape?
Yes. Yeah. And he's also a big conspiracy nut, isn't he?
I think he espouses conspiracies whilst
being on the sex tape. just because I've seen it.
Randy by name.
Yeah.
Just because he's in a sex tape doesn't make him sexy.
I don't know about that.
Well, it makes him a sex object, but it doesn't necessarily have to be sexy himself. But he is of the genre, then.
There's a semantic argument for saying that Randy Quaid is sexy in sex tapes.
Right, well, I think we can segue from Randy Quaid's sex tape quite nicely into The Fabulous Baker Boys, which is our first film this month. So The Fabulous Baker Boys is the story of second-rate cabaret entertainers Jack and Frank Baker, played by real-life brothers Jeff and Beau Bridges, who decide to spice up their act by hiring a sexy new singer, Susie, who's played by Michelle Pfeiffer. Success comes to them quickly, but her presence creates a rift between the brothers when Jack, a womanizer, falls for her and she starts demanding a say in discussions about the group's musical direction. So, The Fabulous Baker Boys, I think the first thing we need to talk about here is Michelle Pfeiffer. First appearance for her on the podcast, a huge star in the 90s. This was her kind of star-making performance.
I believe her name's pronounced Pfeiffer.
I believe you're incorrect.
Okay.
The thing about people calling you up on mispronunciation of words is it's unfair because...
Pronunciation,
yeah.
Fuck. You read these words for the first time in independent reading, so it's because you haven't heard them spoken before. And one of my key main 90s film memories actually is seeing a poster for Die Hard with a Vengeance with my dad. And I said, as we drove past, I was like, I really want to see that Die Hard with a Vengeance. And my dad takes the piss out of me about it to this day. I was 8 years old. He brings it up every Christmas.
Every Christmas. That's
with a vengeance.
With a vengeance. Anyway, Fabulous Baker Boys. Michelle Pfeiffer is absolutely incredible in this film.
Yeah.
I'll say up front, I loved this. I hadn't seen it before. I'd known that there are scenes in it that have kind of entered into sort of legend, which we'll talk about, including the making Whoopi on the piano scene. But it was the first time I'd seen it, and it just, I loved everything about it. But Michelle Pfeiffer is the thing, is the reason, the main reason to see this film.
I think she probably is the standout performance. Yeah, you're absolutely right. That making Whoopi scene is, I first ever saw something like that was the spoof in Hot Shots.
Oh yes, yeah, same.
So I mean, I'd never seen Fabulous Baker Boys myself either. I was like thoroughly impressed, but I was like, ah, that's exactly where that scene is from. That's where they stole it from. But
how about you guys?
I agree. Michelle Pfeiffer is fantastic. My favorite bit about this film is Jeff Bridges.
Yes,
he's brilliant.
I agree.
So a weird comparison. The opening scene that just sets him up as a total badass, super cool guy, and it's done really simply in about a minute. I'm like, I'm gonna like this film. It's really cool. And we've seen some love interest and things in films so far. He's the first kind of genuine hunk we've seen on the pod.
He's so good in it. The delivery of his lines is, he doesn't speak a lot, you know, he doesn't have these rambling monologues, but when he delivers a really short, pithy, punchy line, he's brilliant at it.
Careful, you're going to have me thinking you're going soft on me.
You don't give a fuck, do you? About anything.
What do you want from me? You want me to tell you to stay? Is that what you're looking for? You want me to get down on my knees, beg you to save the Baker Boys from doom? Forget it, sweetheart. We survived for 15 years before you strutted onto the scene. 15 years, 2 seconds, you're bawling like a baby. You shouldn't be wearing a dress, you should be wearing a diaper.
He is absolutely brilliant, don't get me wrong. I think he is playing... He's so cool, though. He's playing, like, the coolest customer. Like, he is sleeping with beautiful women non-stop. The smoking. I don't smoke I'm not a smoker now, but I wanted a cigarette so bad because it is just, he is non-stop smoking cigarettes. So is Michelle Pfeiffer.
I think Jeff Bridges is great, but I think he's very much playing within himself. It's not a difficult role for him. That's pretty much how he's acts in real life.
Right. But then again, if you think like that, the Big Lebowski was 7 years after this. Yeah, they yeah. seem like that's those two characters are played by the same actor. Seems insane.
Yeah, yeah.
Pfeiffer. Well, I did really like Pfeiffer as well. Is that actually her singing when she does the audition?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So she sang every line in the film is sung by her, and I think the actual piano music was played by other musicians, but Jeff and Beau Bridges learned to play everything, so they were
Because
when you look at it on camera, it looks clearly like they're playing it, playing the along with the songs. And actually, I guess sort of focusing on each individual performance is a bit misleading, because it is about their dynamic, the three of them, and they play off each other so well. Obviously, Jeff and Beau Bridges as real life brothers have that kind of chemistry, and it's best kind of it comes out best, I think, in the that they have a, obviously their relationship breaks down a bit with the introduction of Michelle Pfeiffer. They end up having a physical fight, and that feels like one of the more realistic depictions of brother fighting.
Yeah. I've had that fight with my brother before. You're just kind of grabbing and pushing them into a fence and stuff. There's no hitting.
There's no willingness to hit in the face.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of wrestling and kind of grappling, and it just looks pathetic.
The moment you cross the line into hitting the face, and that's when the fight's over.
So the making. The making whoopee scene we talked about. So the sort of middle section of the film is a will they won't they between Jeff Bridges and Michelle Pfeiffer. They have this incredible sexual chemistry and tension going on between them. And there's about four scenes, one after the other, where the tension is just amped up. And it reminded me of, it clearly is inspired by the films of the 40s and the 50s, where they were brilliant at portraying portraying sexual tension, knowing that they couldn't show them actually having sex. And there's that kind of discipline here as well, although it is more explicit than a 40s and 50s film would be. But what I liked about it was the restraint, because you can guarantee if Michael Douglas was in this film, he'd be shot of his thrusting ass every 5 minutes. And not for the first time, I was glad that Michael Douglas wasn't in a film I was watching.
Absolutely right. So and it's nice to discuss what we think is the best bit of the film, like whether it was Michelle Pfeiffer or Jeff Bridges. For the rest of these films so far, we've talked about, we've been arguing about which are the crappiest bits. But this, I've got them written down. I think this is probably the best film we've seen for this pod so far.
Absolutely.
I don't know, man. Lock Up was pretty spectacular.
Apart from Lock Up, obviously, I guess
that's
saying.
Yeah, that's number one.
We're also into another month where we still have instances of jazz, jazz sax.
Well, but the soundtrack.
We also get sexy sax here, which I don't know which I prefer. I quite like this one.
What's the name you'd give the other kind of sax? Just police sax.
Murtock sax. I think there's also an argument, like, Beau Bridges, he's no slouch in this movie as well. He gets across this like desperation, almost like Jack Lennon, maybe, or something like that. You know, they're hanging on at the very beginning, and you can see it. They're struggling, and he kind of gets almost a new lease of life when they do introduce Michelle Pfeiffer, despite it causing all the tension in the group itself.
Yeah.
And even though, like, with the breakdown of the troop itself, it's you see him becoming more and more desperate. I think he's fantastic in it as well.
It's a performance without much vanity, is it? Because Jeff Bridges is so cool and he's so lame.
And more successful than Beau Bridges by far at this stage. In real life. Yeah.
Apparently, he wasn't going to do the role because he kind of felt a bit self conscious that he didn't want to be the older brother turning up and, you know, annoying his little brother at his job. But then when he read the role, he just thought, perfect for me and him to play that together. Because obviously they're real life, and he's obviously far cooler than Beau, so it works well.
You've also got a Michael Bauhaus, Ballhaus, I would say Ballhaus, cinematographer who also worked with Rainer Werner Fassbinder and Scorsese.
Yeah, it looks amazing. Yeah. The scenes when they're out on the balcony, just the framing and the, again, it really enhances this amazing sexual tension between them.
It comes at the end of a period where she's kind of playing hard to get initially. Like, she doesn't want to ruin the relationship, the working relationship. Yeah. And it's kind of ironic that him being such a hunk and such a cool dude, and her being such a babe who's clearly so interested in him, compared to other 90s romances we've seen with a geek and the girl that fall immediately in love.
Yeah.
And that kind of makes the payoff a bit better when they kind of do end up getting
when
together.
When they bone.
Yeah. I knew it was going to cause some kind of issue, but I didn't know whether they were going to play as the older brother is jealous of the younger brother for getting this, you know, attractive woman, for making Whoopi. Mm. But they do it well in the sense of he doesn't really care that he can't get this woman anymore because he's married, but he's worried about the effect it's going to have on the group and their careers, just purely for the financial stuff. So I think that was done well.
Yeah. One of the recurring threads is Frank insisting on ending each set with feelings, the standard, and the other two that think it's so lame and trite. Michelle Pfeiffer's line is something like, feelings is like parsley, you wouldn't notice it. Like, it's fine that it's gone, there, but if it was gone, you wouldn't care about it.
I mean, I like parsley quite a lot, but...
Yeah, throwing shade at parsley didn't go down well.
Not in the Jackson household, no. So.
No.
But okay. does she say parsley, or does she say... Oh, no, it is, yeah. I can't remember what I've watched recently, but it was... Is it cilantro that Americans call
coriander?
Yeah. I never knew that, but
it's fucked up. They call spring onion scallions.
Yeah.
And aubergine eggplant.
Yeah,
Americans are stupid.
Spinach and rucola or something.
I thought that was rocket. Where is it? Spinach.
They
call courgette something stupid.
Zucchini.
Yeah.
I guess because they had a lot more Italian immigrants in the early days of America. Which
keep your reasons to yourself.
That's just
like, we don't have time for the logic.
Anyway.
So yeah, I mean, I loved this film. It sounds like you guys all enjoyed it too.
Yeah, it's super.
Yep.
Yeah, so huge thumbs up.
Two thumbs up from me.
Two thumbs up from Daz. How many thumbs up? Eight thumbs up.
That's four people or five people with two people, one thumb.
What?
There's only four of us here.
Eight thumbs up from the pod.
It's a two thumbs up system for hundreds of years. Come here with your eight thumbs.
Yeah, we'll give this an 8 out of 8.
8 out of 8 thumbs. Okay, so we'll have a quick break now and then we'll come back with some films in brief and some Oscars chat. So just going to have a quick look at some films in brief now before we come on to the Oscars. And it's a couple of films we watched that were big hitters at the Oscars. Born on the 4th of July by Oliver Stone, the story of Ronkovich, the soldier who was paralysed from the chest down in the Vietnam War and went on to become a leading critic of the Vietnam War. I thought this was it's histrionic, but an absolutely unbelievable performance from Tom Cruise that made it worth watching. Joe, what did you think?
Yeah, completely agree. Tom Cruise is fantastic in it. Early on, I had a headache from getting bashed over the head with the message. It was very Oliver Stone. The middle third, the kind of arguably probably most difficult to watch portion with the war and the hospital is really good, and that's really powerful. For me, it kind of tailed off a bit at the end. I didn't really get Willem Dafoe's involvement as much, but overall, enjoyed is a funny word to use for this, but I really liked
it's impressive, isn't
it? It's an impressive film.
Also out this month was Glory. Daz, you checked that out. What did you think of Glory with Denzel Washington?
Yes, I suppose it's similar to your guys' opinion on the 4th of July, really. It's quite difficult to watch in places. It's it's a war film about the 1st Black Regiment in the American Civil War, but the officers are white. And it just explores the difficulty that effectively creates between them. I think they explored too many storylines in it, and none of them really developed as well as they could have. Difficult to watch in places, a bit uncomfortable, but yeah, it was done well. Denzel Washington's really good, and I think he's the highlight.
Yeah, I saw this movie as well, and Denzel's performance is worth the price of admission alone. One of the more entertaining Civil War movies I've seen. I remember seeing Gettysburg when I was younger, and that is a 4-hour snooze fest. Yeah. But Glory spits it can be overly sentimental, and it is difficult watching in parts, like Dad said, but yeah, it's worth it just for Denzel.
So both films were recipients of many Oscar nominations. So we've got in front of us the Oscar noms for 1990. Any of these sort of stand out for you as being particularly worthy, particularly unworthy? I mean, I'm going to start and say I made my opinions on Driving Miss Daisy perfectly clear in the last episode. Driving Miss Daisy won Best Picture, which is just... I didn't realise last month, but Do the Right Thing was eligible for Oscars here. And for Driving Miss Daisy to win Best Picture, Do the Right Thing is kind of weirdly perfect, but also horrendously depressing.
Yeah.
Like the most ham-fisted white saviour movie triumphing over a genuinely incisive, brutal, brilliant film about what racial politics are like in the inner city is it kind of says it all, really. But so Oliver Stone won for Best Director for Born on the 4th of July.
Yeah.
Daniel Day-Lewis won Best Actor for My Left Foot. Joe, you're My Left Foot.
Really big fan. We just missed that for this pod. That was 89. That was nominated for Best Picture and Best Director as well. And based on, I haven't seen Driving Miss Daisy, but if you look at those Best Picture nominations, which includes Born on the 4th of July, Dead Poets Society, Field of Dreams, My Left Foot, those are some big films missing out to something that you obviously think was absolute dross.
It's so shit.
Joe will obviously be really upset to see Julia Roberts get a Best Supporting Actress nomination for playing Julia Roberts in Steel Magnolias.
And we said in the last pod, as well as getting Sally Field's name wrong, the
entire time, who's Sally Field?
Well, Sally Field is not nominated, and neither is Sally Fields her role in Steel Magnolias.
Shirley MacLaine was much better than Julia Roberts. Olympia Dukakis
as well. Yeah.
Dolly Parton was better.
Well, surprise, surprise! Best makeup is won by... Oh no, it isn't. It's won by Driving Miss Daisy. I thought that was going to be Steel Magnolias. Just
garbage.
Just for
Dolly Parton.
Just her doing everyone else's.
You have Diane West nominated for a role in Parenthood, which we saw a couple of months ago.
She was brilliant.
Yeah, that's a justified nomination.
There's Pauline Collins nominated for Shirley Valentine as our regular Scouse correspondent. What do you make of that?
Yeah, exactly. Well, we got a note. Well, actually, I learned that Jeff Bridges' grandfather on the maternal side was born in Liverpool and emigrated to America. Oh, so it's a double Liverpool feature.
You're going to claim Jeff Bridges as a Scouse?
Sure. Yeah, we'll have him.
Bo Bridges as well, then?
Yeah, Bo, Lloyd.
No, so you're not claiming Bo Bridges.
Well, actually, I've claimed Bo Bridges as well. Yeah, he's done some good work.
I'll take any Bridges I can get.
So a couple of nominations for a film that we almost unanimously thought was crap. Black Rain, nominated for Best Sound and Best Sound Effects Editing. Didn't win either. Pipped by Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade for Best Sound Effects Editing.
Please don't speak on my behalf, John. I didn't think it's crap.
But that is, like you said in the last pod, Paul, Black Rain has a lot of things to recommend it, and the sound and the cinematography was something that was,
I think,
quite good.
I think the score is great. Also, I thought the score for Born on the 4th of July is amazing. John Williams. Yeah. Obviously, very different kind of film from him. He's famous for his work with Spielberg, but it's a really uplifting...
The score on Glory is really odd. I was trying to think of how to describe it, but they constantly play soppy, over-the-top music on scenes that they don't really match. It's a kind of music that where... if it's the climax scene of a film and the score builds and builds and builds, and then it's sort of like a dramatic crash cymbals and everything, but they do that all the time for scenes that they're just walking down the road as if it's this big event, but it's not.
Well, there's a possibility that they would have score would have matched the film if Matthew Broderick's performance hadn't been so wooden.
I couldn't believe how bad he was. He's described early on in the film as dashing, and I don't think he's ever been described as dashing before, nor since.
Matthew Broderick is a I don't think I've ever liked Matthew Broderick.
No,
particularly.
Does he go in that list?
I don't think he goes in the unlikable actors list. But I just think he's too weak willed to even be unlikable.
Wow. Ooh.
In my opinion,
he's not even good enough to make the most unlikable.
He's just a spectre hanging around big Hollywood.
Fat nothing.
Yeah.
It seems
Matthew Broderick.
It seems a bit like his charisma just went out the window with that Ferrari out the garage. Can I just say also, there's a few nominations here for Dead Poets Society, and like, well, I mean, I'm not usually a big fan of like sentimental claptrap.
Yeah.
Wait, I thought you were a Scouser.
What was that? Sorry?
Never mind. Yeah, I like Dead Poets Society. I agree. I'm not a big sentimental film guy, but Dead Poets Society is something. It's a heart of stone. Yeah. Respond to a bunch of kids stood on desks.
Yeah.
Saying, "My captain, my captain."
Yeah. When we drive out of school, we get the same treatment. Yeah.
Got the cane. Yeah. There's a few films here that we will be covering soon, including Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Little Mermaid, that'll be coming up soon. Any others here I'm missing?
Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
I think
was that next year?
No, we've gone past that one. And shoot. Field of Dreams we went past as well.
Oh, that's a shame.
That is a shame.
Yeah, so, we say we don't like sentimental claptrap and then we just melt. Lethal Weapon 2, missed that.
Well, there's in the best sound effects editing, there's Indiana Jones, Black Rain, and Lethal Weapon 2. Mm. I know how I'd rank all three.
Really, that should be the best picture.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think you got Back to the Future 2. How did my mistake. The Abyss did win Best Visual Effects.
I mean, that's the sort of pin. That's
it's the dawn of CGI.
The dawn of CGI, an important moment that I'm glad you noted for posterity here.
Unfortunately, CGI wouldn't come good for a good 25 years after this.
Arguably, it still hasn't. Yeah. We can kind of, we should keep checking in on the Oscars to see where, because I guess next year is Terminator 2, right?
Yeah.
And that's the next jump in CG.
Yeah.
Then Jurassic Park's like 93.
Yeah, but they meshed that with practical effects as well, didn't they?
When's Lawnmower Man?
Oof. And
Pierce Brosnan's, I wouldn't go that far. But it's something. Lawnmower Man sure is something. Mm. All right, that's enough for the Oscars. Next up, we are going to talk about one of our favourite actors. Two of our favourite actors.
Yep.
In Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell.
Oh, I thought you were talking about Terry Hatcher.
I love Terry Hatcher. Three of our favourite actors. Sylvester Stallone, Kurt Russell, and Terry Hatcher in Tango and Cash.
Meet Ray Tango. He likes money.
He's your Kong. He's your gold.
But doesn't bother with cash. Meet Gabe Cash. He won't dance around trouble and doesn't mind stepping on toes.
I hate you karate guys.
Two of LA's top rival cops are having a good time staying in rhythm.
You know me, huh?
Yeah, I hear you're the second best cop in LA.
That's funny. I hear the same thing about you.
But they're going to have to work together, even if it kills them.
Right now!
We'll take it.
No.
That's one of a kind.
We won't put a scratch on it. Did you sleep with my sister?
I was so drunk, I don't remember, okay?
Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell. Tango and Cash.
All right then, Tango and Cash time. Tango and Cash, of course, the story of Ray Tango and Gabe Cash. Two of LA's?
I think so.
It's not made specific, but it seems a bit California-ish.
Two of LA's finest detectives. The two finest detectives. Well, inarguably.
Neck and neck by the looks of things.
But they're both second to the other one.
Yeah. Well, judging by the number of column inches that they both get, there's a spinning newspaper headline every 5 minutes.
I mean, the print media is not dead in LA, is it?
No. Should we just do a quick, Joe, do you want to do a quick plot summary of Tango and Cash for the good people out there?
It's useful to have this plot summary because it's only it's only summarised every 5 minutes by spinning headlines, as you say. it's tough to track throughout the film. It's the story of Ray Tango and Gabe Cash, ludicrous names. Who are working the narcotics division of, we think is LA, and they attempt to bring down drug lord Perrett, the bad guy of the piece. And Perrett sets Tango and Cash up, making it look like they've committed a murder of an FBI agent. They are put in prison, and they have to escape and then clear their names.
Clear their names. What do we say about Tango and Cash? I will say something first. This film is one of the most aggressively stupid films I can remember seeing, and that is not necessarily a bad thing. It, you know, you talk about action films being empty-headed and sort of and turn your brain off, but this is that to the end. This commits to being stupid, yep, in a way that very few films do.
It's like they've just watched all action films in history just before they filmed it, and they want to cram every single stereotype into it.
Yeah,
there's loads of just unnecessary explosions. The entire dialogue is just stupid, cheesy one-liners, and there are two very hunky naked men joshing in the showers at each other.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of, we said it was that lockup that there was a homoerotic element to quite a few of the scenes in that, but
this
Hangover in Cash takes things up a notch.
Yeah.
I made a compilation video of bromantic moments from films a few years ago, and Tango and Cash features in it quite extensively, and it's the only bit in the video that has actual male nudity in it. There's one of the most gratuitous arse shots, double arse. There's just a 5-minute portion when they're in prison where there's a joke about, they joke about the size of each other's dicks in the shower.
Yeah. Yep.
About 5 separate prisoners threaten to either anally rape them or stick various objects inside their
upper ass.
Yeah, it lays it on thick.
What are you doing? Relax. Soap. And don't flatter yourself, Pee-wee.
I don't know you that well. Don't worry, Cash. Someday the other one will drop.
Attaboy, tripod. Just keep talking.
Good thing, Minnie Mouse.
How do you think about the setups that you got for the two main characters? So we saw earlier how you set up a leading man as a badass with Jeff Bridges.
Yes.
Like a very quick, like 30-second, 1-minute opening scene where he leaves his latest conquest in bed, and you just think, right, he's a cool dude, he's a badass.
Hey, then, now, Joe,
do you think that's cool
because he's had a one night stand?
That's the implication from the film.
I don't think
that's cool.
But we don't think that's cool.
No, I think he's a slut.
Yeah. And now you're slut shaming Jeff.
I am, this is
a PC pod, guys. Can you try and keep it that way?
The Michael Douglas setup from Black Rain, the motorbike scene.
Are we going to reference Black Rain?
It strikes me as an important.
I have no issue with that at all.
An important kind of point, kind of rock in the stream that sets the tone for a lot of. A lot of intros. So Tango is introduced chasing down a lorry single-handedly, and then
he's also out of his jurisdiction in this case.
Yeah,
he's
absolutely.
That doesn't bother him though.
Jurisdiction.
And then what Cash's intro is,
it's him getting shot 3 times in the chest with a shotgun.
And
it's not explicitly stated that he's wearing a bulletproof vest, but he's absolutely fine.
It's never mentioned. And also, there's no holes in his t-shirt either when he's been shot as well.
Yeah, that is the most unlikely.
I think in the precinct, they do mention he's got a bulletproof vest because you see him plucking it out. And he said, this shirt cost me $9.
Later in the film, he does get shot in the shoulder.
Yeah.
And he gets up and says,
it's his elbow, isn't it?
Shot his arm. He's like, it's fine, it's a clean exit. And then he carries on mowing down people.
Not only that, he high fives with that same arm later on at the end of the film.
And a strong high five as well.
Yeah. Mm. Followed by newspaper spinning around with those two high fives
like back in the game.
I mean, I love Sylvester Stallone. I think he can be fantastic, like Copland and obviously the Rockies, First Blood. But his delivery of some of these lines, it's
dreadful. So here's the thing, it's because he's trying, someone's told him that this is an action comedy, so he is trying to do comedy.
Mm-hmm.
So his sort of intonation for all the lines, he's like stepping, he steps on them, he's kind of like, like he puts the emphasis in entirely the wrong, every wrong word. What's the word, what's the counting calories line.
Looks like you don't count your calories. Well, is that because you're too busy counting all your money from me? Who paid you off?
It's not, I don't think it's the worst delivery of lines in the film. Is it
wait, before we even get into the line I think you're going to say, that we need to mention that there's a scene with Kurt Russell in full drag.
Oh yeah,
that's the one that we talked about.
Yeah. Is this what you're referring to?
No, it wasn't.
Oh, that's the thing. Every single moment in Tango and Cash is insane.
I'm talking that is. You're right. Absolutely insane. I'm talking about the English enforcer bad guy who speaks in. It's like it's comparable to like Anthony LaPaglia's attempt at an English accent in Fraser.
Yeah. Piss off! Bollocks to plan, eh? I like this. It feels great up here.
What do you say?
Plan A's a loser.
Hold on. Give me a name, Death Brother. You're going back to fucking England in a fucking baggie.
Up yours, also. You ain't worth a toss. Go on, drop me. Do it.
It's one of the worst English accents I've ever heard.
Well, Stallone tries to do an English accent in the film, and if your accent is worse than Sylvester Stallone's, then you know it's terrible.
Oh, no, it's still worse.
So no, I don't think it is.
What does he say?
Don't you know ponytails are out this season?
Don't you know ponytails?
So what's... Stallone loves that accent, and there's a story behind why the guy has this English accent.
Right.
Originally, he was just an enforcer and he had two lines in the film.
Yeah.
And he didn't have a big character. So to stand out, he put on this accent. Stallone loved it and wrote a bigger part for him.
Wow.
Hence why you get the, you bloody wanker.
Yeah.
Bloody
wanker. Every line is, these blokes are bloody wankers. Yeah. They're toss off, you bloody wankers.
That's a good line. But I think the line that Paul was thinking of was when Kurt Russell was in drag, coming out of a club with a Terry Hatcher, pacifist police.
To navigate past a police presence, he goes undercover in full ridiculous drag.
He looks like the female gremlin in Gremlins.
Yeah.
I didn't think he looked that bad.
Well, Kurt Russell's a good looking
man. Well, one of the police officers didn't think he looked that bad.
No. Yeah. So, did you want to say?
Oh, no, yeah, I think might be my guest.
Yeah. So as he after he checks his ID and lets him pass, he just says incredibly nonchalantly in front of his chief, any chance of a three-way?
To both Terry Hatcher and Kurt Russell.
Yeah, yeah, he's like, here's your idea, any chance of a three-way?
Yeah,
no, it's not. It's, you know, you don't shoot your own school. It's a polite inquiry.
Yeah.
It's
just
true.
Just hold on 1 minute, bit, chief. Any chance of a three-way?
It's kind of indicative of the film as a whole, just people just throwing whatever they think of at the screen and whatever sticks. Yeah, we'll have a terrible Cockney show up and talk like fucking Dick Van Dyke in Mary Poppins, and we'll have Kurt Russell in drag for like 1 minute for some reason and then never refer to it again. Terry Hatcher can do a quasi striptease in front of a massive fan in some sort of bastardised cabaret club.
You've got Jack Palance chewing the scenery and doing an inexplicable dialogue about these two mice in his hands which he's using to represent Tango and Cash, and then on his bar by his cocktail set up he's just made a maze for these rats and mice to work with.
It doesn't
make any sense.
It is made, like, we're looking into the production history of it, it was made it went through a series of directors. The officially credited director is Andrei Konchalovsky, who directed Runaway Train, which is an amazing kind of existential action movie made by Cannon Films in the mid-80s with John Voight, and it actually resulted in an Oscar nomination for a favourite of the pod. Anyone want to guess who the other actor in Runaway Train is who got an Oscar nomination?
Eric Roberts.
Eric Roberts is correct.
Yeah. That was a joke.
Oscar nomination for Eric Roberts.
Wow.
You need to check out Runaway Train. Everything about it is very unlikely. He was on the film, got fired, creative differences, was replaced by Albert Magnoli, who was the director of Purple Rain, one of my favourites. And at this period, as we kind of talked about with Lock Up, Stallone was pretty much directing his films as well. So you had a lot of different influences coming together on the set, and that's what maybe resulted in unusual tone.
It's very easy to pinpoint exactly which scenes were Stallone's input as well.
Oh, one line I've just remembered. At the very beginning, someone says to Ray Tango, played by Sylvester Stallone, hey, who do you think you are, Rambo? And he replies, Rambo is a pussy. And then he shoots a
truck full of cocaine or something.
I thought you were going to say shoots a wink at the camera because it was that obvious.
Yeah, it's like the weirdest meta joke.
Here's the thing though, like he shoots the truck because the front half of it has got cocaine and it turns out, but they check the top and the back. There was still bloody gasoline in the back of the big HGV.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, I'm a chemist and used to work particularly in the oil industry. It's probably not my best idea to be shooting bullets anywhere near that.
I mean, they don't reckless. They don't follow all rules of explosions in this film, do they? There's the rampage at the end, things explode completely at random.
Yeah,
and the grenade gets shoved down the Englishman's pants.
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah.
Rolls down the stairs. You get to the bottom, but then the explosion happens halfway up the stairs where they've obviously put the explosion.
Another thing I noticed, electrocution. There's a sort of quite intense electrical torture scene of both Tango and Cash. It seems like quite a 90s or 80s action movie trope. Like, you had there's Lethal Weapon, there's that torture scene with the electricity, and then in Lock Up, of course. Big, very, very in vogue electrocution.
Derry Gurr for Stallone movies.
Brings me on to the actor, one of the actors in this who dies by electrocution, has this really massive chin. And yeah, I don't know whether it's supposed to be a joke or is it what?
No,
is it prosthetic?
Tango broke his jaw.
Yeah.
In the backstory, apparently.
Right, and he's had it restructured or something.
I guess so, yeah.
So, no, that is Robert Zadar, who is... he plays Maniac Cop in the Maniac Cop horror series, and that is his jaw. He's got very...
Blimey.
So Stallone broke his jaw in real life.
and turned him into the Maniac Cop. Yeah, exactly.
Kind of looks like, you know, that prosthetic on, like, Stanley Tucci's face in the Hunger Games movies, almost.
Yeah. It's an amazing face. So, yeah, Tango and Cash, I mean, it's the definition of, like, you can't say whether it's good or bad. It's just, it's extremely entertaining. It is not boring.
It's stupid.
Every second is so dumb.
Yeah.
That you always have something to enjoy.
Yeah.
It's exactly like Best of the Best last week, where if you watch it with a group of friends and you can laugh at it together, it's really enjoyable. But I don't know whether you'd be sitting down to watch it on your own
with your mum.
Yeah.
But the thing is how with something like this, because it's so funny. Like there is something great every minute. How much of it just seems very unlikely that any of it was done on purpose.
Yeah,
because Stallone, what you can tell from his line readings is that Stallone is one of the most humorless people around. Like, he doesn't know what is funny or how to be funny.
Yeah, he doesn't have comic timing or delivery or anything like that. He just says things in a tone of voice and that's that, and then he says something else a bit louder.
Yeah,
and that's basically it.
He mistakes volume for tone. I should mention that obviously Kurt Russell though is brilliant.
Yeah,
like he's so natural and funny. And so he's doing the. It would be interesting to see what if there was an actor who could come across as vaguely human opposite Kurt Russell. I mean, as I say, I do love Stallone, but he's not the right person for any kind of action comedy.
You'd like to? I know you're a big fan, Daz. I think Schwarzenegger could have been good in this. He's got a lot more comedy timing and...
I will say that in the playground argument, who's better, Stallone or Schwarzenegger? Schwarzenegger's definitely funnier than Stallone.
Yeah, absolutely. Sure.
Schwarzenegger's genuinely funny.
Some movies.
He's funny. He's funny in Commando when he's not even trying to be funny. You know, the material is obviously grade A.
But his timing is great.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe it's he had a lot of help. From directors and stuff, but the timing of his one-liners are funny.
And if Stallone is directing in this or having an influence over the direction in this as well, he'll do his line and everyone knows that was rubbish, but no one will be able to tell him that was rubbish. Let's do that again, it'll be that's in the can, let's move on to the next one.
But there must have been some quite heavy editing in the director's cut of this, because they've cut out once again quite a large part of administration that was short at the end of this film.
Yeah.
Escape from prison and then kind of running amok through the bad guy's lair. It's a really weird, really weird location for the scene. And then, it cuts straight to the headline of them being reinstated and high fiving on the front page.
Yeah. Yeah, we did watch all this together. Needs to say, Joe, aka PC Paperwork, is furious at every point. Every administrative process wasn't being detailed. Needless to say, when they're reinstated back into the force immediately in the final shot after blowing up, There's a lot of unanswered threads.
But something else which needs a little questioning and answering is the kind of the Q James Bond like department that we seem to have in the police force.
Yeah.
What was going on there? Like, this guy, he's just building all this explosive and like special kind of equipment. In fact, he sets them up with a parents' RV, but he's just put a minigun on the side of it.
Yeah, he builds it to spec in a matter of hours.
Yeah, yeah.
With first time in 1990 as well.
Oh, you can't use this, it's just a prototype.
Yeah. What's that noise? It's like, well, no, we're not smashing up your car when it's obviously completely ruined.
Destroyed.
Yeah.
Another thing from Bond, or a similarity that you have with a lot of Bond films, henchmen can't shoot.
Nope.
They
sure can die good though.
They die real nice, but they shoot a lot of metal poles. they certainly don't shoot Tango or Cash at any point.
They'll get
close.
Some sparks flying.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
I thought you were going to say they're shooting blanks there.
Also, the main bad guy played by Jack Palance, who, again, don't really know what he's doing in the film exactly in each scene to scene, but like he's a weapons dealer, arms dealer, drugs dealer.
Yeah.
But his facility, which is somewhere presumably in like the middle of California, it's got a self-destruct mechanism.
Yep. Yeah.
It comes to standard on a bad guy's layer. Yeah.
Do you think Stallone wanted someone a bit more subtle than Donald Sutherland for the main bad
guy? I was thinking, who's the more over the top? Yeah. Is it Jack Palance or is it Donald Sutherland? So Tango and Cash, though, in what? Yeah, what do you say? In summation, I would highly recommend watching Tango and Cash. Yeah. I wouldn't want to go any further.
I'd say, like, a once,
you should definitely watch it.
Once in a 10-year movie, kind
yeah,
of
thing. Once. Yeah.
I feel like I could watch Tango and Cash again this week.
Shall we do it on Tuesday?
It's really fun nonsense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's a very YouTubeable film in that there are some brilliant lines that you'll just want to watch again and again.
Yeah.
But then a lot of the filler, maybe not.
And also, we mentioned it briefly before, but this was a prime ITV late night film.
Yeah.
It's where I first saw it.
It's maybe where I first saw boobs.
I haven't seen that. What's that? Is Sylvester Stallone in that one too?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we've got three films left for you, War of the Roses, Weekend at Bernie's, and Rude Awakening. And they have a kind of common thread linking them. They're all comedies, but they all satirise yuppie culture and the kind of greed is good culture of the 80s, Thatcherism, Wall Street, Gordon Gekko, etc., etc., to varying effect. So we are going to start off by talking about War of the Roses. So Adam, do you want to just take us through what goes down in War of the Roses?
Sure. We got Barbara and Oliver Rose, played by Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas, respectively. They seem to have a perfect marriage until one day Barbara imagines what life would be like without Oliver and kind of decides that she'd prefer it. A bitter custody battle ensues for the house that they've set up over the course of their marriage, and you get their lawyer, Danny DeVito, who's also the director here, caught in the middle.
This is the most romantic day of my whole life.
This is the story we're going to tell our grandchildren.
Barbara and Oliver Rose.
Wait a minute, wait, what's your name?
Barbara!
They met great.
I love rain.
God, I love it too.
They agreed on that.
Are you happy?
I'm more than happy. I'm married.
This house is so beautiful. And we live here.
House, car, boy, girl, puppy, kitty. The poor bastard's never had a chance.
Your crystal is lovely.
Baccarat.
I didn't know anything about this before I met Oliver. My mother bought her glasses at the A&P, you know, the kind with the raised...
It always starts with the little things.
And that phony laugh.
Okay.
All right, maybe overdid it. Let me have it.
If love is blind...
Now I got you.
Marriage is like having a stroke.
When I watch you eat... When I look at you lately, I just want to smash your face in.
Smash my face.
I want a divorce.
You can't have one.
When a couple starts keeping score, there is no winning. It's only degrees of losing.
Okay, so War of the Roses. Pop favourite Michael Douglas is back. Were you pleased to see him? Joe, you pleased to see Michael Douglas again?
No. Empire film review of this. Taking one sentence from it. Douglas presents a welcome return to form after the disappointing Black Rain.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. He's better in this. I still don't like him. I wrote, I think it's his voice. Or his smug face. I don't know what it is that I don't. So I'm. It's a bad trait, but I'm predisposed to dislike this film because I dislike Michael Douglas, and that's a bad thing.
So this is a film where, and it's unusual you get this with a big Hollywood film where every character in it is horrible. Everyone. It's very rare you have a black comedy that commits as hard as this does. To making everyone reprehensible.
Yeah, it's very hard to pick a side between the two, isn't it? You're supposed to, obviously there's a parallel with a cat and dog. She likes cats, he likes dogs. You're supposed to feel like you should be backing one of them over the other, but you don't like any of them.
No.
Yeah, I mean, one of the blackest dark comedies I can think of.
It reminded me of one of my favourite books is High Rise. And I don't know if you've seen did you see the recent film?
I did. No, I read the book. Really liked the book.
Yeah. So it's very similar to High Rise in that it kind of it's about yuppies, and there's social sort of class, it plays into it a lot, and these kind of minor disagreements over, again, dogs. There's a lot of dog trauma in High Rise as there is in War of the Roses. These kind of minor disagreements escalate until by the end of High Rise, they're all feral. And they're degraded into cannibals and are attacking each other. And likewise, in War of the Roses, by the end, these kind of like minor marital spats have led to them just literally tearing each other apart and tearing their house apart. I thought, I said, from a kind of point of view of satirizing the 80s and that whole culture, I think it was really effective just because, it totally committed to depicting them as incredibly dark and unpleasant people.
Yeah.
The dark comedy has done really well in this. One of my favourite scenes was where it's when they don't have much money at the beginning, when Douglas is a lawyer, but he's just beginning, and he's working late nights, and the mother gives them some sweets, and Michael Douglas tells her off, said you shouldn't be giving them sweets or something like that, and she said, well, actually it's been shown in studies to be really healthy for children if you give them what they want, so then they don't just go mad on it when they're allowed it. And then the next scene, the kids are really obese in about 5 years' time.
That's such a great joke. And it's like so unusual. You see fat children in a Hollywood film, and it's not like, you know, it's not like they're, I mean, they are the joke, kind of, but it's...
Well, it's more touching upon the marriage itself. Like, she is, pandering to the kids' behaviour, and he's a bit more distant.
That she would deliberately... She would dig her heels in and deliberately make her kids mad to win an argument. It's the kind of pettiness that I can really... get on board with.
And when they're buying the house, she walks in, she keeps going into random houses asking to buy them, and it hasn't worked for a year, and she walks into the house to buy it, and it's actually the woman who owns its wake. Just dark things like that are
that's
really
like
funny.
An episode of Frasier or something.
So those two bits you mentioned there, those are really funny, but I wrote down in my notes, at what point did it stop being funny? Because there is a cut off, and towards the end I didn't care for it.
Yeah, I agree.
There's a cut-off point, maybe the sauna scene or the cat or something, where I just... I like a black comedy, but...
Do you think it's gone too far?
I don't think it's gone too far. I just didn't think it was done that well. I know what you mean. You've got to have... They really commit to the black comedy, and they're all dislikable in many, many ways. But... I think some of it works when there is some sympathy for some of the characters. Like, I didn't feel particularly sorry for Michael Douglas when his wife didn't go to visit him in the hospital.
Mm.
And that's because of the character he plays. And I think you're right, it is quite a good performance, and he does play dislikable people very well. For it to really land and have an emotional impact, you've got to care a little bit. And I didn't care.
I guess what I would say in response to that maybe is that the injuries they inflict on each other, both emotional and literal later on, are so unpleasant but also recognisable. You know, like you can see how they would occur in a dysfunctional relationship. If you did care about the characters, it would be too painful to watch.
It wouldn't be
watchable. Like if this was, if one of those characters was a good person, it would just be you couldn't watch it. You'd be watching behind.
Yeah, it all escalates because they are pretty.
Yeah,
nasty individuals.
Yeah, really. There's no compassion.
Yeah.
There's no real sort of love between them. And actually, it's interesting you said about the sauna scene, because I loved that scene, and I. That was a good example of Danny DeVito's direction, I think, is amazing. These kind of Hitchcockian set pieces, well, like the sauna scene being a key example, where you get these crazy camera angles from like the top of the stairs and like under the door. And
also like when Kathleen Turner's trapped in the attic, there's some great shots there. Also you got the shadow playing, so it makes it look like there's bars, almost like a jail in there somewhere.
We also see another Harvard scholarship in this film, just to get that in there. I think that's three months now.
That's not too bad.
So. Yeah. Also, some more blowjob trauma. God forbid you try and get a blowjob in a 90s film, because so far we had a car crash at Parenthood, and then Kathleen Turner...
He absolutely deserved that because he's getting
it's Michael Douglas, he deserves everything.
And also when they're getting together, the tactic of auction flirting is risky, because you're effectively flirting with someone by costing them more money by upping a bit. And I don't think that would ever work. It just really piss everyone off.
And that's how the whole relationship starts. Yeah, well, it's a sign of things to come, isn't it?
Speaking about, because obviously they get to the auction, she outbids him on this little trinket, which was $50, but that auction seemed like it would be a bit more expensive than that.
Yeah.
But then they go back to his place in Nantucket, they have sex, and then immediately after they're smoking a cigarette in bed, and I think Michael Douglas maybe says, this is a story we're going to tell our grandkids. What about fucking within hours of meeting?
Yeah, I like how they use the way sort of sex is used as a weapon in it. Again, it's like,
well, there's a GoldenEye style crush.
Turner does a Xenia on the top.
What do you make of? So, you spoke previously about how uncomfortable you were at the thought of Tom Hanks having sex. This pod, we're confronted with the thought of both Jeff Bridges and Michelle Pfeiffer having sex. Totally fine with that. Michael Douglas having sex, what are your thoughts?
I mean, it's kind of, there are very few Michael Douglas films where he doesn't have sex, so it's just kind of something I've come to terms with over the years, following his career. As I said, it's especially from like here onwards, so Basic Instinct is yet to come, isn't it? But Fatal Attraction's been and gone.
Yeah.
Then things like Disclosure.
I think he had implied sex in like Romancing the Stone and Jewel of the Nile, maybe.
Yeah, of course, and they're worth mentioning because of Danny DeVito. Clearly good pals, the three of them. I think also what I thought was, you can see why Danny DeVito did Matilda, because him and Roald, this feels like a kind of Roald Dahl, one of his adult short stories.
Something like
Tales of the Unexpected Switch Bitch, exactly, that short story that he wrote. Yeah, it's so willing to offend you. It's a hard film to love, but I really enjoyed it. I appreciated the performances. I thought it had some interesting things to say about relationships.
I loved it myself as well. I mean, the performances were all on the money. The story, I liked the format. I mean, it was a little bit cheesy, but the format of the story being told is Danny DeVito, who's an old colleague of Michael Douglas, recanting the story to Dan Castellaneta in a silent role. But recounting the story as a kind of precautionary tale that he's offering for free advice upon. Did you know in Germany, I think this film was called Rosenkrieg, which means Roses War, and that is now a shorthand for a bitter divorce battle, often for custody of children. And a lot of people in Germany don't know where it comes from.
It's interesting as well, because I was saying this is a huge box office hit.
Yeah.
You'd think the prevailing wisdom is that if films are really unpleasant and you don't like the characters, and they don't do well at the box office, but maybe it's just indicative of a different...
Although, speaking of characters we do like, we have someone from the top of our unlikable list starring opposite someone on our likable list, Sean Astin, as one of the kids. Doesn't get a lot of... screen time, but yeah, likeable chap.
The animals don't come off well in this film. There's a scene where Michael Douglas slaps the cat off a chair, which
that
comedy for comedy. I like that.
We established that you like
animals
being punched in some form.
also there's a scene later on. Well, Michael Douglas runs over the cat and then has to bear it. There's a scene after that where you obviously know this. You know that the cat's dead, and she makes pate, and you have to. You think, is it going to be the dog, or you know, has she killed the dog and fed it to him? I was convinced it was.
But then you see the dog.
And then you see the dog is all.
So I was reading in the IMDb trivia page that they deliberately put in a picture of the dog, a shot of the dog, to kind of make it clear.
But I think it would have been so much better if they hadn't.
Yeah.
Because it would go in line with the dark comedy of the film.
Because
that would be that would be really tight. Yeah, leave it open.
For
my notes, I've got she Scott Tenemans him with the dog, referring to the South Park episode.
But then towards the end, it gets very Home Alone-y.
Yeah. also reminded me of The Money Pit. Have you ever seen that with Tom Hanks and Shelley Long, I think?
Yeah, that must be coming.
Which again is another yuppie film. That two young couple buy a house, a dream house, that just it falls apart and ends. It's a lot of physical comedy, but I remember it being just terrifying as a kid. Like, I don't know why. Maybe I really wanted to own a house, fuck knows. But yeah, I enjoyed it. You mentioned the soul bass opening sequence again, sort of keeping with this Hitchcockian theme.
Exactly.
But Joe, you didn't seem seem so big on it.
It was good. It was better from Michael Douglas.
Better from Michael.
Better from Michael Douglas.
Keep up the good work, Michael.
But he's
C plus.
A C plus. It's up from his kind of E minus for Black Rain, I think. He's
not
for
that.
He's a dislikable person playing a dislikable character. Mm-hmm. So that kind of works. Catherine Turner's good. Danny DeVito's really good as well. I like watching him. He's.
I would also put maybe Danny DeVito on the likable list.
Even though he plays reprehensible characters, like for example his character in Taxi or something like that, there's always something underneath. But he's a likable guy, man.
So just for posterity, the likable list is Sean Astin,
DeVito,
Danny DeVito,
Tom Hanks.
We poo-pooed at Elijah Wood, which is fair enough.
Yeah, Elijah Wood didn't make the cut. And then dislikable is Michael Douglas at the top, far and away.
Sean Penn.
Chris Penn.
All the Baldwins.
All the Baldwins except for Alec.
Oh, yeah. Alec can probably get on there as well.
Over my dead body, does Alec Baldwin go on the most on the dislikable list?
Right. I wouldn't want Alec Baldwin on the dislikable list.
No. All right, well, that's established. Okay, so War of the Roses... recommended if you like fucked up dark comedy. So then next up, we're going to have a quick break and then we're going to talk about another dark comedy, Weekend at Bernie's.
Don't you see, we just uncovered a $2 million error. We're going to be heroes. We're going up the corporate ladder.
It appears as if somebody's trying to defraud the company.
Somebody tried to smoke it past the wrong guy.
Very, very good work. How would you two like to come to my house at the beach?
Love to!
For Larry and Richard.
How are you?
This is a place to die for.
You have to kill them, Vito.
I'm a little rusty, but it'll come back to me.
What, should we just walk in?
But what they don't realize...
No, we'll stand out here on weekend. Come on, we're out again.
...is while they're checking in...
Forget the accident with the two guys. Take care of Lomax.
Bernie Lomax will be checking out.
Oh, my God!
What kind of a host invites you to his house for the weekend and dies on you?
So, time for some corpse comedy, guys. It's Weekend at Bernie's. Daz, do you want to talk us through Weekend at Bernie's?
Yeah, it's a story about two rising stars of an insurance company called Larry and Richard, and they're rewarded for the work with a holiday at the boss's plush estate on Long Island on a beach. However, the death of the guest of honour at a beach party leaves the enterprising duo with a problem no amount of training could prepare them for.
That problem being...
He dies.
He dies and they cart his dead body around for 90 hilarious minutes.
I wouldn't agree with that.
So, we've established prior to this that there's a bit of a divide here. I thought Weekend at Bernie's was pretty good. Thoughts?
Yeah, see, I mean, after like the first 10 minutes of the corpse being around, like it's just the same kind of gags over and over.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. They've just it's one good gag, which is then having to be spread out for a very, very long time. Yeah. I mean, it is interspersed with good physical comedy, and there are chuckles and there are things, but. Yeah, it could have been a. I think it could have been a, maybe an hour long short story rather than a for feature length.
Yeah, I mean, I watched it alone. I'd admit, like that's probably not the best environment for watching a comedy. But I mean, so Mark Kermode often says if for a comedy for him, it has to be six big belly laughs. I don't think I had a single one.
I did have one where the body bot washes up behind when they're getting on the beach. I thought that was funny.
That's amazing. I think, isn't it three? Six is a lot. Like
I think he says six.
I laugh a lot. I laugh more at the cinema than when I'm watching stuff at home. Yeah. But if I get three big laughs, I'm good. And yeah, there were. I was surprised at how much it actually did make me laugh throughout. Joe?
I'm in your corner, Paul. I really enjoyed this. I thought it was quite a lot of fun. The best part of that one joke of him being dead and them having to kind of conceal that fact. I like the reactions of the hitman. Is it Vito, the mob hitman? He's brilliant. His kind of shock and horror and then insanity at keep seeing that Bernie is apparently alive.
Yeah,
I think that's where you get some. A couple of those big belly laughs that Mark Kermode wants us to have.
Yeah. And also, looking at it from the point of view of it being a satire of the kind of emotionless, nothing but like materialistic 80s, that one joke is a really good joke. And particularly from the initial scene where, to their horror, the boys see that the partygoers are kind of talking to Bernie, talking at him.
Yeah.
And they don't realise he's dead. Like that is a brilliant that whole set piece. I think is really good and really effective. I think at sort of conveying the self obsession into their kind of world of these yuppie scumbags.
And we both kind of independently came to the same note on this.
Yeah.
About there being a comparison with one of my favourite books and then one of my favourite films, American Psycho, where. Depending on the theory about it, you believe that all these crimes that he commits did take place and people intentionally ignore them.
I actually went back and checked because I was like, I thought this must be one of them. That this Weekend at Bernie's came out in 1989 in America, and American Psycho, the book, was 1991, I think. Yep. This must have been one of the videotapes that Patrick Bateman takes out. You know, he's always returning videotapes. Yeah, Weekend at Bernie's had to be one of his favourites because of the way it plays this horrific situation for such broad laughs. Like, again, it's weirdly unnerving and like in a way that I think so-called black comedies now wouldn't really go that far, I think.
Should have been out there sailing with us today, Bernie. Sun was fabulous, wind was fabulous, we had a great time. Oh, hi, guys. Hi. Love you, darling, just love you. You know, you could use a little sun. We're going out again tomorrow if you want to go. Lie on the deck, catch those rays. Don't worry, I'll help myself.
He's dead.
That's the idea, is it? Cheers.
Hey, Bernie.
Hi, Bernie.
Hey, dude, you need to pump some iron.
There are a few funny bits which aren't on the slapstick scale. One of them being when the character of Richard takes the girl back to the flat. And he's trying to kind of explain how he can afford this really plush flat without letting her know that he's living with his parents. So he tells her his parents are dead. And he says they died on a train. And she says, well, I always thought that trains were safer than planes. And he has to say, well, actually, the plane fell on the train.
And then you get his dad walking in his underwear.
Yeah.
And there's a great line where he tries to pretend that he's his butler. And he says, oh, geez, could you lay out my suit in the morning? And his dad replies, how about I lay you out? And that his dad is played by the director, Ted. That's a cameo from Ted Kotcher. So one of the most mind-blowing things about this, revisiting this, directed by Ted Kotcher. Ted Kotcher's filmography, he directed First Blood, the first Rambo film.
Wow.
I think we could all agree that's probably up there as one of our favourite movies.
I don't know if I'd go that far, but it's, I think it's a fantastic, it's by far and away the best Rambo, probably the best Stallone film, I would say.
There's a whole pod to be had about that.
Well, well, look, I'm kind of taking the entire Rocky franchise.
Ah, right, okay.
I mean, you can't.
You've got Copland as a possibility.
Copland's fine. I'll put First Blood about Copland.
Yeah, I'll put First Blood ahead.
We need to talk about this, not Stallone. We've spent a lot of time talking about Stallone. What are we talking about?
Ted Kotcheff.
Okay, so he directed First Blood, which is a really brilliant film. And then Waking Fright, which is one of my favourite films,
yeah.
Which is an incredibly dark story about toxic masculinity in Australia after a school teacher is trapped out in the outback for a weekend and is taken on a kangaroo hunt and is
it's one of the bleakest films.
It's incredibly bleak and just a masterpiece, and it was a big inspiration on Scorsese after it premiered in the Cannes Film Festival in the early 1970s. For him to make that and First Blood and this just blows my mind. What a range.
Mm.
It's time to revisit the work of Ted Kotcheff. That's your next BFI season.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
No. Another thing that I noticed is that so Richard, who's the sort of straight man of the pair, is played by Jonathan Silverman. Did anyone just look up anything about him?
I can't remember anything particular.
So Jonathan Silverman, I looked this up kind of early on, I think before I watched the film, and Jonathan Silverman is the high school best friend and best friend to this day of David Schwimmer. And once you know that, you can't unsee it.
Yeah, that makes so much sense.
They are identical.
Yeah,
blimey.
They talk and look exactly the same.
Mm.
That's worth noting.
So I heard that Corey Haim and Corey Feldman were in contention to play those roles.
Too.
I think I would much rather see that film. I mean, I'm a huge Corey
Feldman.
You're a
big mark for the Coreys, though, aren't you?
Well, I'm more of a mark for Feldman than Haim, but you know.
Fair enough.
Yeah.
What else have we got here?
Oh, the song. The Some Like It Hot, which I think is actually called Hot and Cold. You know, that was written by Andy Summers from The Police.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's just an incredible crew of people who worked on this film.
I mean, that song was alright if it wasn't being played for the entire movie.
Yeah. One thing that really made me laugh in the trivia for this, there's a spoiler section. In the spoiler section for Weekend at Bernie's, it just says, body count, one. Really enjoyed that. But yeah, it does feel, just in the way that it deals with death and murder, it reminded me weirdly of Pain and Gain, which is much more morally unacceptable because that's an actual account of murders that happened in real life. I'm assuming this isn't based on a true story. but who knows? But yeah, just that way, it's a broad comedy with the most horrifying subject matter.
I think you've talked me around, actually. Maybe it was 1.5 thumbs up.
Stay strong.
Looking back, it does have some really funny moments. But I just think it's the same guy.
The sight gag of him, because the direction is great, because some of the framing of the sight gags is brilliant. When he washes up on the beach,
that is
brilliant. I do have a big bone to pick with Weekend at Bernie's, though. The love interest character, the girl that Richard is has this kind of crush on, brings the whole enterprise down because her character makes zero sense. When she finds out what's been going on, the fact that she doesn't run screaming to the nearest police and run away screaming from him is completely unacceptable. Yeah.
Well, that's because she's really into the kind of insecure, slightly geeky guy.
That's
unusual.
It's irresistible.
Yeah, you don't normally get that.
Never worked in my experience.
But we criticise it in like the Adam Sandler, Seth Rogen films, but here, this guy's a sociopath. She needs to get away from him. In my opinion. So Weekend at Bernie's, I've really enjoyed it.
Worth to watch.
Not for me. It's not for me.
Not for you.
Yeah, I thought I was going to like it, but I think I've only ever seen it.
To hear that.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen it before, but like little bits when I've like flicked over the TV.
Hey, maybe you'll like Weekend at Bernie's 2, that's coming up
soon. 1993, right?
Yeah.
Or probably 1997, no,
I've,
UK.
I've never seen Weekend at Bernie's 2, so I'm intrigued. It can't still be Bernie.
Yeah, Bernie.
If it's the same, it would sort of the 90s into the same guy.
That'd be really strong satire on this culture. If they're like, kind of wheeling a skeleton around.
Decomposing rotting body.
They got the guy from a Scotch videotape advert to play Bernie.
Yeah. Another good bit of trivia that I... another good trivia that I saw was that... the stunt double for Bernie broke all of his ribs because he was his role as a stunt double was just him being dead weight and just being cosseted around, especially in the scene where Bernie's being dragged behind a speeding boat.
Yeah, that's good.
Oh, it's brutal. Like, when you go watch it with that knowledge, it's even darker. All right, so that's Weekend at Bernie's, and so next up, our finale. The Cheech Marin and Eric Roberts comedy Rude Awakening. Ugh.
From the producer of Trading Places comes Rude Awakening. The LA Times says some of the funniest and most inspiring comic moments of any picture released this year.
Have you been drinking?
Just a little, honey.
I own tanning swans.
They came back after 20 years to find nobody wanted to save the world.
I mean, people pay me to get a tan.
Oh.
They just wanted to buy it.
Hey, how do you get the sun to shine just on those guys who pay, man?
I hate you. I hate your mother.
There are people dying. And you tell me there's acid in the forest. There are missiles. There are plague.
Yes! The system worked!
Cheech Marin, Eric Roberts, Julie Haggerty, Robert Carradine, Cindy Williams, Buck Henry, Andrea Martin, Cliff DeYoung, Louise Lasser. Rude Awakening. The film that opened in 950 theaters nationwide and supported by $5 million in theatrical advertising will be backed in its video release with eye-catching theatrical-sized posters.
Whoa.
And 6-foot 3D standees.
Wow. Hey, Zeus, look at us, man.
Sure to make Rude Awakening the best comedy renter.
Did you like the movie, son?
Okay, then. Rude Awakening is about two hippies who return to New York after 20 years hiding out in the jungle of Central America in order to blow the whistle on a secret invasion that they discover is being planned by the CIA. Once home, they are shocked to find their pals from the 60s pursuing yuppie lifestyles. So, what do we say about Rude Awakening?
Absolute shite. Terrible.
One of my bugbears is people who, when they go and see a film at the cinema that's like a bit average, like a romantic comedy that's a bit dull, and they come out and go, "Oh, that's the worst film I've ever seen."
I just think they've not seen Rude Awakening.
Yeah, they haven't seen Rude Awakening. Exactly. Yeah. They haven't seen enough bad films. I think it's good every now and again to watch a film like Rude Awakening to understand how bad things can go wrong.
Yeah,
how bad things can get.
I mean, you said the word comedy in your introduction there. I mean, that's a bit of a stretch.
Yeah, it was hard to say.
Yeah, I mean, was it a comedy? Was it an earnest look at an earnest satire about the 80s and the 60s themselves? Or was it none of those two things?
It was neither of those things. It was just a load of random scenes from presumably different films, from actors who weren't looking at the same script and not being directed by the same person, cut together at random.
Yeah.
It's the comic relief, the character, but is it Cheech?
Yeah.
Who is supposed to be the comic relief is not funny at all.
Yeah. Isn't Cheech? Or is Cheech
Marin?
Yeah. But he isn't funny at all.
Yeah, that's the thing. Exactly. He's the one to provide the... Eric Roberts is a straight man.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
But he's even less funny than Eric Roberts.
Yeah.
Mm. Oh, look at the view.
Where's the lobster?
Oh, where's the lobster? Dig it.
Aren't you Dial a Lobster?
It's Fred and Jesus.
I didn't order Mexican.
Mexican? You didn't order Mexican?
That's right. It's me, Fred. Fred Wook.
My God. Jesus?
Hey, I am the lobster. Cuckoo-cuckoo.
Baby.
And then the other character is Julie Haggerty.
Yeah, this is really bizarre. I obviously recognise her from Airplane.
And we all love Airplane.
And we all love Airplane.
It goes without saying, we all love Airplane.
Daz?
Yeah, I love Airplane.
I thought she was putting that voice on in Airplane.
Oh no, she speaks like that.
That's so bizarre. And then her kind of her character, it's just so strange to try and talk about this film as if it's a normal film, to talk about characters and storyline, because you can't, because it's all so stupid and hodgepodge and all thrown together. But Julie Haggerty's character is one of the ones who's left behind in New York and then is rediscovered as some kind of
fashion designer
type thing. But it's crap. She's crap as well. They're all bad. Everyone else.
Eric Roberts is, you know, I love Eric Roberts. We all love Eric Roberts. Daz?
Love Eric Roberts.
Good, yeah.
Wait, but when did that become agreed?
That's law. Okay. You being on this podcast is based on you loving Eric Roberts.
Welcome to the Eric Roberts podcast.
Exactly. He's like the most unconvincing hippie ever. Like, if I was there, I would have him pegged for a narc immediately. He's just like, great smoke, man. Fuck off, Eric Roberts. You're going to shop us all to the CIA.
Yeah, I mean, it's a stoner film, but it's not very appealing. It's, it kind of makes drug culture look terrible.
What's that smoking fish gag that they keep with the talking fish with the giant mouth?
Oh goodness. So, I think just so they could get the fish lips gag about getting the end of your spliff wet.
One of the recurring characters is a puppet fish that Cheech Marin hallucinates.
Only he can see,
and he gives the fish a joint, a smoke of a joint at one point.
Can I get a hit off of that, man?
What?
Let me get a hit off that joint.
Huh?
Yes.
Yeah, sure, man. Wow, fish lifter.
Are you hallucinating?
Huh?
Man, those research assholes sure fuck you up.
What makes you think that, man?
And the final shot of the film, I mean, we'll tell you the end, because you shouldn't watch Rude Awakening under any circumstances. The final end of the film is the fish emerging from a manhole in New York and spouting some nonsense. And because the lake that he came from has been set on fire due to pollution. And so the smoke coming up from the drain, and Cheech Marin goes, smoked fish. And the fish goes, smoked fish. And then they both say it two more times, and then Cheech Marin does a peace sign. Then it ends, and then the title card comes up saying, this picture is dedicated to all the people who care about the planet. Be good. Then Revolution by the Beatles starts.
No.
It's
a cover version by Mike and the Mechanics. I promise.
Oh god. Okay, there's a cover version of Revolution by Mike and the Mechanics, and then there's a sing-along lyrics like the bouncing ball at the bottom of the screen. Mm-hmm. I've never felt more insulted by the end of a film in my life. It seemed like the biggest fuck you ever.
I mean, before that you have like Eric Roberts's like, they basically, his crew, old crew, Cheech, Eric, Julie Haggerty, and this other character called Sammy, who's pretty incidental, they kind of overtake a university building. They all go in there, and then he gives a big speech to his crowd, which have assembled because they're trying to get in to go to lectures. And god, it's just a fucking stream of consciousness bollocks. Don't even know what he's talking about most of the time. He's like, yeah, the acid rain's bad, and so's
good. Yeah, and then there's some sixth form comedy thrown in that, where the second page of the speech has been used to roll a joint with. Sorry, man.
Cheech.
The brainstorming session where they're talking about all the bad things in the world to protest about.
Yeah, so they talk about like AIDS and like you said, the Colombia, like Central American coup and dictatorships and things. It's just like a checklist of all the bad shit that was going down in the world at that point. For what purpose? Like, what? you're right. I mean, hippie culture looks worse than yuppie culture in this. So whatever point it's trying to make,
it's
something. It's also just, it's so, it's clearly made, the budget was clearly about £100.
Yeah.
And the first 5 minutes is all stock footage of like,
that was far too long.
Of like woods, like the most basic stock footage of the 60s. And the soundtrack is Rainy Day Women, 12 and 35 with Bob Dylan, which is Everybody Must Get Stuck. Yeah. The entire song.
Yeah.
It's just execrable, excruciating, the most obvious possible 60s shit. And then it just keeps going.
It is as if it's been made by A-level students for the project.
Yeah, yeah.
Just, it tries to be profound when it doesn't really have a profound message. Yeah. The comedy doesn't hit home. The story is confused.
Yeah.
To put it politely.
I think, like, the earnestness is insulting, I think, as well. Yeah. When it's so flimsy, like, you're going to try and be earnest about these kind of like big political subjects or environmental subjects, then be earnest, but then keep doing some throwaway comedy as well.
Yeah, you can't have them both. You can't have this profound message about the saving the environment, etc., and then have a smoking fish.
So
I will begrudgingly mention one positive about this film. Louise Lasser's in it, who was in Requiem for a Dream. And there's one moment that I thought was relatively good and was a decent comment on kind of yuppie culture, where that was their kind of hippie hangout when they were hippies, her kind of cafe restaurant type thing. And then when they go back, she is now serving all these yuppies. And I thought that was the one and only kind of reasonable comment on gentrification, where she says something like, they just turned up and they won't go away.
And she's charging them a fortune for what she was previously selling for nothing.
Other than that, rubbish.
I don't think it's enough to redeem everything
else. Oh, God, no.
Interesting thing, this is another film with two directors, always a great sign. And the two directors have interesting backgrounds. So David Greenwalt went on to be the leading producer, one of the lead producers of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, and Slayer, and the executive producer of Angel, wrote many of the most popular episodes of that. So he kind of went on the up.
We were all a big Buffy the Vampire Slayer fan.
Of course.
That's
a big fan, yeah.
Then the other director is Aaron Russo. So this is interesting given the subject matter of the film. He went on to, he was a producer, he produced Trading Places, and he produced various films in the 80s, but he then went on to fund, direct, and write a bunch of libertarian documentaries about how taxes in America were eroding civil liberties.
Oh yeah.
So that's quite interesting that,
given, considering what he just made a film about.
Yeah. What the fuck?
Did he get hit in the head or something?
Maybe.
Yeah.
It's a real oddity, Rude Awakening. There's an amazing Roger Ebert review where he gave it a rare zero stars, where he sort of strikes the, like, I'm not angry, I'm just very disappointed line, and just recommends everyone involved
take a good look at yourself.
You know, moves on to other things.
Yeah, if anyone out there listening takes anything from this pod, it's don't watch Rude Awakenings. It's not a oh, that'll be funny to watch because it's so bad. It'll be a complete waste of your time as it was ours.
You should make more effort avoiding this film than actually watching Tango and Cash.
Yeah, but please don't let it affect your opinion of Eric Roberts.
No,
everyone makes mistakes. Eric Roberts, this is Eric Roberts' biggest mistake.
His nadir.
Indeed. Well, that's the nadir of this pod, I think. So that's a good point to finish. So I guess we're gonna do a performance of the month as well as a film of the month.
Yeah.
All right. That's what I think about this.
I think we might all have come up with the same answer here.
I'm envisaging I was thinking we'd all
plump. Let's just go around. I'm gonna go around from Daz clockwise. Film of the month, performance of the month. Daz, film of the month.
Fabulous Baker Boys.
Performance of the month.
Jeff Bridges.
Joe.
Fabulous Baker Boys. Jeff Bridges.
Fabulous Baker Boys. Tom Cruise.
War of the Roses. Denzel Washington.
Oh, wow.
Did not see that coming.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Wow.
But I think it's
So it's Fabulous Baker Boys and Jeff Bridges.
Mm-hmm.
Takes it.
We've probably seen in this pod the best film we've seen so far during this run of pods, and the worst film.
Undoubtedly. Mm-hmm. Do you think we'll see it? Do you think we can possibly see a worse film than Rude Awakening this year?
Ooh,
the thing about it is that, as well, I didn't mention Rude Awakening. There's nothing less heartening in cinema than watching a film, a comedy film, and 5 minutes in you realise, oh god, the people making this have no idea what is funny.
Yeah.
And you're there for the next however many hours.
And that's exactly how people will feel after 5 minutes of this part.
Oh my god, there's still an hour to go.
But Stallone gets away with it. He doesn't know what's funny, and yet.
Yeah, but we don't all have the genius charisma of Sly Stallone.
Absolutely.
Alright, well that's it for this week's episode. So we're going to play out with the single biggest hit in March 1990 in the UK pop charts, and it is, of course, The Power by Snap. So does anyone want to dedicate any ideas for who we're going to dedicate this to?
I would like to dedicate this song to Kurt Russell, because the power that he put into that final high five with Sylvester Stallone, despite the fact he had a bullet in his elbow, was something quite spectacular.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm happy with that. Or I want to dedicate to Jeff Bridges' cigarettes, because they maketh the man.
Yeah. Nice.
Wait, so him sleeping with someone makes him cool, and now him smoking makes him someone. Yeah, we got a problem there.
Mm.
I would probably go for Sylvester Stallone, because of the power in a particular line, which I hope you'll segue into this section.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. The line that you'll hear on this pod at some point.
I think I'm going to dedicate The Power by Snap to David Greenwalt, the director of Rude Awakening, because he managed to recover from making one of the worst films ever made to go on to create two of the most beloved TV shows of all time. And that's something to respect, I think. So yeah, that's it for this week. Next time, we are going to be looking at April 1990, and films we're going to be covering include The Hunt for Red October, Look Who's Talking, and Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. So if you want to get ahead of the curve and watch those to be ready in time for the next episode, please do so. And if you'd like to email us in, please do at the90smoviepod@gmail.com. Sorry, that's 90smoviepod@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook at 90smoviepod. Follow us on Twitter at 90smoviepod, and please subscribe via iTunes, and please leave us a review as well, as we try and spread the word about this. That's it. Thank you. Bye.
Hey.
Diet, it's obvious. You're not too interested in counting calories. Could it be that you're just too busy counting the money they paid you to set us up?